want your soul.
I never looked into stories about deaths or murders, but this one caught my attention more than any other. The headlines were mysterious deaths at local camp begins to catch national interest. This article was in an old stack of newspapers that my dad had kept that had important shit in them. This one had the London train bombings in them, and the article that had caught my eye was in bold underneath. The camp in question was called Camp Blue Jay, and it wasn't very far from where I lived. This story is just what I need for my senior research project on local events. This article was published back in 2004, so tracking down the counselors or kids was rather difficult. I did find one counselor named Blake Jernigan, whom was interviewed in the article I mentioned. I looked Blake up in the phone book and on Google Maps, but no information appeared. I eventually found some old phone books from 2004 in my parents' attic and found his name, and he lived relatively close by. So I got the directions to his house, and I followed them. The house was overgrown with weeds crawling up the siding and infesting the yard. Ivy was finding its way through every crevice along the brick chimney at the front of the house. I walked up to the front door and knocked, and waited for about a minute or two, but no answer. I knocked again, and I glanced over at my car, which was still running. As I glanced, I noticed a curtain in the house move, as if someone were looking out at me. I began to bang on the door harder and ring the doorbell. Finally, a man answered the door, but he appeared to be scared. He was obviously a recluse. He was pale, with reddish-brown hair and with a very thick beard. "Hey, I was wondering if Blake Jernigan still lived here? It's about his experience at Camp Blue Jay," I said to the man. The man looked at me as if I were crazy and told me I should keep my nose out of places where it don't belong. It was at this point where I thought he would slam the door in my face, but instead, he invited me in. "My name is John Jernigan. My brother Blake killed himself about a year ago," he said. His house smelled of cigarettes and cat piss. I'm so sorry to hear that. My name is Tyler Pearson. Did he ever tell you about what happened at Camp Blue Jay?" I asked him. "No," he said as he turned to the kitchen, which was down the entrance hallway. "I was a counselor there during the murders as well, though." I looked at him, confused. "Well, who said anything about murders?" I asked. And he gestured for me to follow him into the kitchen. The kitchen itself was rather clean, to my surprise. To the right of the door was John, sitting at a circular table with three other chairs underneath. I pulled out one and sat down as John began to light a cigarette. "Well, it all started about the second week of camp. I was a counselor at the age of 17, which was younger than all of my peers. The camp was big in the sense that the main cabins were the size of mansions. Each age group had their own cabin, and the girls were separated from the boys and so on. In the main cabins, there was a giant study area in the entrance and a kitchen behind a privacy wall. There were picnic tables all along the foyer and bookcases all along the walls to the left. We always served breakfast, lunch, and dinner at the main cabins, and during free time, some kids would come in and read the books that we had, or they would bring their own books that the parents sent them. Anyways, at dinner on the first day, I sat with the 10-year-olds, and they were talking about fishing and what they caught earlier that day. I looked over at Blake, who was with the 7 and 9-year-olds, but he didn't notice that I looked at him. Well, as the night went on, we made the kids go to bed at around 9:30 the first night. As the counselors were settling into their bunks, we heard a scream come from the girls' cabins. I went with Amy, one of the girls' counselors, to go look to see what the girl was screaming about. We walked to the girls' cabins and saw all the kids crowded around something, some of them throwing up as they ran away from the crowd. We pushed the kids out of the way to find a little girl, mauled and gutted on the ground. Amy turned away into my chest and started to cry. I told her to go back to the cabin and call the police. As she was walking away, my first thought was that it was a bear that killed her. But bears don't usually come around here. But if they did, I doubt one would violently attack a small girl without being provoked at the least. I looked around and I didn't see any bear tracks on the ground, only rather large shoe prints. I looked at her chest and it was busted open. All of her entrails were leaking out from her ripped t-shirt. I was holding back the vomit at that point, and I walked into the nearby girl's cabin and grabbed one of the extra blankets and covered up the disfigured corpse with it. I couldn't believe what I was seeing. I'm surprised I didn't puke putting the blanket over her. It took about 20 minutes for the police and paramedics to show up. We were questioned as the coroner took the girl's body away. The police were asking us what we were doing and where we were when we heard the scream. Well, everyone's stories aligned, so the police told us to watch out for bears, and they told us to tell the kids that the girl is fine, and she's in the hospital. But why should we lie to the kids? The majority of them saw what she looked like. Her intestines were pulled from her stomach. Her chest was ripped open, and her neck was ripped open. The police obviously knew something that they didn't want to tell us. I didn't sleep that night at all, and I was scared for the rest of the summer. Amy probably didn't sleep either, but I didn't want to ask her. She already seemed on edge of breakfast. My brother and Matt, the two senior counselors, went up to the front of the dining room area and told the kids that the little girl was fine and in the hospital. Small bits of conversation arose and died down as the two counselors made new rules about leaving the cabins. Matt and Blake walked back to the counselor's table and sat down. I walked out of the main cabin and saw something fluttering in the distance. It was a black balloon tied to the stair railing of the cabin that the little girl was from. I thought it was something the kids did out of respect, so the rest of the day went on as normal, but with counselors escorting the groups to their next activity rather than letting the kids walk free to them. At dinner, the counselors all began to talk to one another about the balloon tied to the railing at the little girl's cabin. All of us decided that we shouldn't raise the issue to the kids and that we should probably forget about it. All the kids were talking about their activities or the events of the night before. That night, the counselors were making sure the kids' cabins were locked after they were sent to bed, and the counselors put walkie-talkies in each of the cabins so that the kids could radio them if they needed to use the bathroom. At around 10:30 that night, Matt noticed that the lights were on in the 10-year-old's cabin. He tried to radio the cabin, but there was no response, only static. So he and I went to go look to see what was happening over there. We walked down to the cabin and were about to knock on the door when we heard the boys screaming. We quickly unlocked the door and ran in to find the boys were telling ghost stories about some killer clown named Binky. We asked if we could listen to their story about Binky the clown as well, and they let us. Jason, the boy telling the story, said that Binky was an escaped psycho that liked to butcher little kids. He said that Binky is watching them right now, and that when Binky kills the kids, he likes to place balloons on the porch of the murdered. "Jason," I said, "Binky isn't real, right?" But when I said it, I was legitimately scared. I knew what killed that girl wasn't a bear. And then I thought about it. If Binky the clown was real, then why wouldn't the cops have told us? "Yeah, of course Binky's real," Jason said snootily. "He escaped from the asylum like 10 years ago, and according to the fifth graders, he lives around here, on the camp." "You're not getting scared now, are you, John?" asked Matt, who looked at me as if he was about to laugh. "It's just a fucking ghost story. Just relax," I said, and I waited until Matt and myself were gone so I could tell him the strange correlation between their ghost story and what happened last night. "Matt, you didn't notice that during the story," and Matt cut me off before I could finish my sentence. "John, just chill out, dude. It's a story. Okay, maybe the boys put the balloon there when we were all at breakfast." And now that he said it that way, I didn't think about it. Maybe they did put the balloon there. But maybe they didn't. But I did want to investigate this Binky legend a little bit further. The next day came and I finally slept through the night. I still had thoughts on Jason's story, though. This seemed a little too real to me. Maybe I'm just crazy and scared from what happened the other night, but I couldn't get the thought of it out of my head. I needed to find out whether or not this Binky the Clown was actually a real person or not. I wanted to have some closure on it. I told everyone that I wasn't feeling too well, and Blake said that he would take my kids for the day. Of course, I was lying to research this killer clown, but I couldn't have done it having to watch the kids too. Besides, I still got paid anyway. I used the counselor's computer to Google child killers in Illinois, and the usual suspects appeared, like John Wayne Gacy. But the problem with Gacy is that he was executed by injection in the 1990s. And to my surprise, there was a news article that was published in 1994 that said that there was a serial child killer named Nathan Holder that had escaped prison. Apparently, Holder killed 17 children and is accused of killing at least 30 more. The details of his killings were gruesome. All of the victims were killed violently by being gutted and drained of their blood by slitting their throat. After he killed the kids, he would gut the rotting corpses and then throw them into a well in his backyard. In 1987, Holder had left town to go to a business meeting in New York and had his neighbor watch his house for him. Well, his neighbor went over to give Holder's dog some water, but the faucet in his kitchen sink wasn't working. So his neighbor remembered there was the well in the backyard. When he pulled the bucket full of water back up, he looked in and found a small hand in the bottom of it. He then called the police, and Holder was arrested within a week. All of the recent child disappearances were linked to Holder, as dental records showed that it was the missing children, that he was the culprit after all, and hiding in plain sight. Holder later admitted to all the murders and said that he kidnapped the kids by dressing up as a clown and luring them into his house. After he would kill them, he would go to the family's house and tie black balloons to their porch posts. He said in court that he made the balloons out of the souls of the children he took. After I read the article, all I could think was, holy fucking shit. I couldn't bring myself to tell the other counselors. They wouldn't even believe me. I should have told them sooner, though, but I didn't. All of the deaths that happened at Camp Blue Jay were my fault in one way or another. Dinner came along that evening, and all I could think about was Binky. I saw him everywhere. Amy looked at me with concern and asked if I was okay. I wasn't, though. Yeah, Amy, I'm fine. Why do you ask? She said she was just wondering. I was concerned that I was coming off as crazy and that if I told anyone what I had learned today, they would think I needed to resign. So I kept my mouth shut. I eventually excused myself from the table and walked outside onto the deck. I followed a path down to the lake and began skipping stones, and I noticed a bright color walking in my peripheral. I look to my left and I think I see a clown, but I blink and now nothing is there. Perhaps I'm losing my mind at this moment. I then hear screams of children and the stomps of their feet as they came running into the water for their after-dinner swim. I guess I was the lifeguard on duty, as no other counselor came after the three boys. The boys were about 10 years old, and then I noticed one of them was Jason. Hey, Jason, I yelled. Can you come here for a minute? Oh, yeah, sure, John, he yelled back. As he was walking up to me, I kept on the lookout for that clown and looked at him with disbelief. Where did you hear that Binky story? I asked him. I really wanted him to tell me that he made it up. I read it online, I think on this ghost story website. I then believed that he got the kid-friendly version. He left out all the bits that said what Holder did to his victims when he told the story the previous night. Yeah, you know, and did it say what Binky's real name was? I felt like this kid was confused that I wanted to know so badly. After all, it was just a bullshit story, right? I think it was like Nathan Heller or something like that, he said with uncertainty. You know, I honestly don't remember, John, but do you mind if I go back and swim now? He then ran back into the lake and started splashing with his buddies, whom I didn't recognize. They then all stared at me as Jason presumably told them what I asked him about. They probably all think I'm scared of this little ghost story that Jason told. But in reality, It's what the story was based on. And that's what was scaring me. A week or so passed without any incidents as I began to believe that it was a bear that killed the little girl. Why would a psycho killer stay around after he escaped prison? He probably booked it for the border as soon as he broke out, right? I mean, Nathan Holder was sentenced to death at his trial. I certainly wouldn't risk staying around here if I was him. It just had to be Jason and his gang who tied that balloon to that girl's cabin. I mean, they did know the story after all. That night was ghost story night, as the kids told their favorite stories of horror. Jason told his usual shit about Binky and those goddamn balloons. And Amy and Matt told a story about some high beams and a killer in the back seat. I was too busy thinking about Jason's story again to listen to them, though. The details that reflected the girl's death so accurately. The younger kids were scared by Jason's story, and they asked Amy if it was even true. Amy, of course, denied it and took them back to their cabin. And Blake and I sat on the deck looking out onto the lake so perfectly reflecting the moon as Matt took the boys to bed. Blake, if I tell you something, would you believe me? I asked him. I was a bit nervous. If it's not batshit crazy, John, go ahead. And he began to laugh and look at me. What do you mean? What is it? You got an extra dick or something? Spit it out. I just looked at him like a deer caught in headlights, and I began to swallow my pride and told him all about the Binky story and how it was actually true. John, quit fucking with me, okay? We talked about this. We beat it to death. It was a bear. I didn't care if he wasn't getting it or not. I needed to show him the article, and so I led him to the counselor's computer and opened the article up, and he began to read it. Blake looked stunned. Matt was in the bedroom with Amy, and we didn't want to disturb them. That's when we heard another scream that was cut short. We sprinted outside to find bloody drag marks along the ground, leading to the woods. No bear tracks either. Just the same shoe print as before. Blake ran back inside to the main cabin and told Matt and Amy what had happened. And Blake and Matt ran out together with flashlights, minus Amy as she was calling the police. We need to follow those goddamn footprints, Matt said. And we followed the prints to an open field, with a tree standing alone in the middle. There was nothing around us except for the cries of bugs and the hoots of the owls. We couldn't see anything for about 20 feet. The footprints had ended once we got to the field, so it was just a matter of searching for the kid. But we still didn't know who we were missing. I walked to the tree to see if I could find anyone. And I looked at the ground all around the tree. And then I noticed there were blood drops on the ground. I looked up to see Jason, lynched from the tree branch, hanging in the air about 10 feet up off the ground. I started screaming and wailing, and I turned onto my stomach and threw up all over my hands as I had tried to contain my vomit. Matt and Blake ran over and asked what I was screaming about, but I couldn't speak. I just pointed at the tree branch with Jason's corpse hanging from it. Blake turned from his normal rosy color to paper white, and Matt just fell to his knees in disbelief. Everybody knew that it wasn't a bear this time. Why would this be happening to us? What did those kids do to deserve this? The police came with the ambulance, and we led them to the tree with Jason's body hanging from it. They were as mortified as we were. This murder now definitely meant that the camp was going to be investigated, and the kids were definitely going home now. Everybody ruled out that there was never a bear accident. We were all questioned by the police as they cut down Jason's body. It looked like his Achilles tendons were sliced as the back of his ankles had extremely deep cuts in them. Binky the Clown definitely wanted it to be known that he was present at the camp. As the coroner examined Jason's body, he began to call the detectives over to look at what he discovered. It was barely revealed that a somewhat small written word was carved into Jason's skin. And as he kept lifting the shirt, the word became more apparent that it wasn't a word at all. It was a sentence. And it simply said, "This boy is Binky's." And so, now you know that that's what happened that summer at Camp Blue Jay. And John now appeared to be caught up on his own story. Well, did they ever catch him? I asked. I definitely hadn't the slightest idea. I believed at this point that John was so scared of Binky that he hadn't left his house since it happened. Nope. No, they didn't, John snapped at my question. He's still out, around the campgrounds, somewhere. I looked at him for a minute, and then I looked away as I wondered if it were appropriate to ask what happened to Blake to make him kill himself. John, can you tell me why Blake committed suicide? I just spat out the words as if they were poison, and the words seemed offensive, but I didn't know how else to say it. You know, Tyler, I don't think he could deal with the images of the clown haunting him in his dreams. He couldn't cope with it. Jason hanging from the tree, the girl. I just don't think he could get over it. John then looked down at the ashtray in front of him and put out a cigarette. Binky also put balloons on our porch, ma'am. Well, John, then you're the only one that can prove that Binky's still out there, I said. I don't know what was running through my mind at that moment. I can't even bear to think about going to that camp to prove that the killer is still out there. John kept looking at me like he expected me to ask him a question that was on both of our minds. But he obviously didn't want to ask, and I finally got the balls to do so. John, do you want to go to the camp and have a look around? I couldn't believe I just asked that. It's like asking a shooting survivor to go visit the shooter's graves. It seems so disrespectful. Yeah, I actually would like to go with you, he said, to my dismay. I knew in the back of my mind, though, that we couldn't go alone. If we told the police we were out there, we would surely be arrested for trespassing, unless we came back with evidence of Nathan Holder actually living somewhere in the camp. John seemed slow at first to pack what he needed, but when he was ready, we set off. When I was sitting in his kitchen, I heard him talking on the phone, more than likely telling someone he would be out of town for a day or two. He knew how to get to the camp, so we made small talk as he periodically told me which way to turn or which road to stay on. The final time he said make a right here, we drove past a brown highway sign that was covered in mossy green filth that simply said, Camp Blue Jay, half mile on the right. At this point, we both knew what we were getting into. Either we were wasting our time, or we were walking into a psycho killer's backyard. And I hope it's not the latter. By the time we had gotten to the camp, it was already dark. The small gravel parking lot was covered in pine needles and smelled of rotting leaves. I think we should sleep in the car, John, I said, and I immediately got back in and closed my door, but John was sitting with the door open. The feeling this place was giving off felt like we shouldn't be there. It felt like we were already being watched, but since it was so dark, I didn't have a sense of direction. The only light in the area was coming from the cabin of my car, as John had the door open. John silently agreed with me and closed the door. I guess he felt the same way I did. You know, I think I'm already having some thoughts about this, and I stated the obvious. John looked at me and nodded his head. He appeared so paranoid. Well, he was quiet this whole time, most likely feeling the same gut-wrenching feeling I was having. The emptiness of this place is so eerie. The slightest bumps in the night had us on our toes. John and I made small talk about the camp and where Nathan could possibly have hidden while he lived there. One of the places John brought up so many times is the far side of the lake. The reason being is because it's all wilderness. I made a mental note to bring up that location when we set out in the morning, but I knew neither of us would sleep because of the tension we were feeling about being in this small, dank parking lot. It must have been about 2:30 a.m., and I guess John had forgotten where he was, as he was asleep. I couldn't sleep myself. And I was scared shitless about being here anyways. The only sounds I could hear was the wind rustling the trees and the sound of John slightly snoring. As I was looking around, I saw something move in the dim moonlight just near the hood of the car. It wasn't an animal. It was something bigger. I locked the doors and started yelling at John to wake up, and he sprung awake and looked at me. Dude, why are you waking me up? Something's fucking moving around out there, man. Let's go home. Let's just get out of here. We'll come back in the morning. I was almost to the point of tears now. I couldn't hardly stand the fear. No, man. We came this far. Let's just stay here, John said. I then looked out my window and I saw it was a deer. A buck. I guess that my imagination was just playing around. John then leaned over to me to look out the window and shook his head and went back to sleep. I felt so embarrassed. As the embarrassment faded away, I, too, began to fall back asleep. All I dreamt about was finding Nathan and him killing the both of us. It's hard to escape the fact that we are in a location that is home to a serial child killer. John was still asleep, so I manually unlocked my door and stepped out to stretch. The warm morning air felt good to my skin, but as the wind picked up, I heard a noise. The slightest noise that sounded like a ball bouncing on the floor. I turned around to see the entire roof rack of my car had black balloons tied on it. The warmth left my body in chills, then went down my spine. I scurried back to the car and vaulted up to slap John on the shoulder. He awoke quickly and looked at me with a really confused and angry look on his face and yelled with a tired tone, "What the fuck is the matter with you?" He was more annoyed than anything, but I couldn't speak. I just pointed to the ceiling of the car and he followed the gesture and got out of the car, staring at me the whole time with the same face of confusion and tiredness from when he woke up. As he stepped out of the car, his face went from confused to shocked, and he collapsed onto the ground. I ran around the car as quickly as I could to help him up. I reached down to help him stand, and he hit my arm away. He was crying hysterically. I could see that the fear had finally gotten to him as well. After a few minutes of comforting him, we cut the balloons off of the roof rack of my car and set out into the woods. As it was the night before, the slightest sound of leaves rustling had me on edge. "We're coming up on the counselor's cabin," John said, leading the narrow trail. I thought of his story about what had happened here almost a decade ago, and it just became so much more real because now the story has a face, being this desolated camp. We approached the counselor's cabin from the winding trail and put our packs down and pulled out our knives and flashlights. Nathan could be anywhere. I walked up to the door and pulled down the condemned tape from the frame. I wiggled the doorknob and it wouldn't give. It was locked. I took a step back and kicked next to the knob, freeing the door and opening up a place of darkness. I then walked through the threshold and I could smell the rotting flesh. The only light in the room was from the crevices of the boarded up skylights above, leaking out onto the floor below. I turned on my light to examine the room. John behind me, watching the door. My heart was pounding. At this point, I started to wonder why I was here in the first place. I mean, who the fuck cares if Nathan is still alive? I then heard a board creak in the far corner of the room and quickly turned to it and vanquished the darkness with my light. And then I noticed something reflected my flashlight. I was shaking. I felt horrible approaching this thing. It was a gift box. Wrapped with shiny metallic paper. It wasn't here when I first looked through the cabin. I tossed the present aside for a moment as I examined the area around it to find that some of the grains on the floorboards ran differently than the rest of it, making it so obvious that they were crudely replaced. I took out my knife and stuck underneath the mismatched planks to open a trap door, and I quickly got back in case anyone was inside of it. But nothing was. As I called John over to examine the package, he looked at me and then looked back at the box. "John, I found a trap door over there. I think it's a tunnel system, maybe, or something else." He then looked at the box himself and opened it to find a small note card folded over. He then read it aloud. "Nice car," it said. We looked at each other and sprinted back to the parking lot. We were halfway on the trail back to see a large amount of black smoke billowing from the lot. As we arrived at the lot, the flames had completely engulfed the car. The once white paint was now charred, and the tires were melted. The area around the car had red gas cans scattered about, Holy shit, I screamed. What the hell do we do now? John looked horrified, as if he had just realized that we were in big trouble. He sat down and buried his face into his knees. I then walked over to my burned car. The only thing holding me back was the immense heat. It dried my eyes out to just look at it. I turned around to talk to John about what our next plans were, but I noticed he wasn't there. I jogged back over to the start of the trail, over to the cabins, and I saw him walking down a path, about 100 feet into the woods. I called out after him, but he ignored me. I then started jogging to catch up to him, and he slung his pack down on the ground. What do we do now? I tried to ask as sincerely as I could, but he wasn't in a solid state of mind, and I could tell. He unzipped his pack and turned to me and said, "We're going to go find him." This confused me. "Well, John, why don't we just do the sensible thing right now and call the cops?" I pulled out my cell phone and unlocked it. John then got up from his one-knee posture and slapped the phone out of my hands and began to stomp on it. "What the fuck are you doing, man?" I yelled at him, as I was getting genuinely scared now. These woods were getting the best of him, and I could tell it. "That fucker is out here hiding in these woods, and he's the sole reason why the only person that loved me is now dead." His voice was starting to strain now, and he went back to his backpack to pull out a Glock 17. He started again. "You think I'm gonna go another 400 hours of community service because someone called the cops? Because I was trespassing?" I focused more on the gun than I did than what he was saying. I had a gut feeling that the round in the chamber would soon be passing through my brain, and John wasn't in the sort of state to be holding a gun at all. "John, listen, I know how you're feeling, but please, why don't you let me take the gun?" I quickly thought of a lie. "I use guns all the time with my dad, so I know how to use it. I've actually never fired a gun in my life, not even a BB gun." He then looked at me, and then back to the gun. Then he reluctantly handed it over. We then headed towards the counselor's cabin to investigate the tunnel we had found earlier that day. As we walked into the cabin, we both approached where that trap door had been found. Instead of it being open like it was when we left it, it was closed now. I quickly looked over at where John was standing, but he was gone. I instantly went into panic mode and began shining my flashlight all around the room. I began to run back to the door, but as I got closer to it, the door began to shut. I was running so fast at this point that I didn't care about John or anything more, and I just wanted to get out. And the door was now shut. I tried to open it, but something was holding it from the outside. I gave up and tried to break one of the windows out, but I couldn't pull the boards covering them off. I then heard a loud thud come from behind me, and I slowly turned around from the window. I shined my flashlight back over the trap door and noticed that it was now open again. I sprinted over to it and dropped inside, closing the door above me. The entire tunnel smelled of stagnant water, and the rotting flesh smell was even more potent down here. It was difficult to breathe, but I kept moving to make sure that I had a lead on Nathan, so I could at least make a run for it when I found an exit somewhere. The tunnel was so cramped that I felt like the walls were getting smaller as I kept moving forward. The only sound of the tunnel was my feet rapidly moving, wading through the rather shallow water. But then I suddenly heard something fall down into the mucky soil behind me. I turned around to see a pair of muddy and torn polka dot pants about 50 feet away from my back. And I immediately picked up the pace and came to a fork in the tunnels. I opted to go right, hoping that this way led me to the far side of the lake. Even though I was moving as quickly as I could in the stank tunnel, I could hear the sound of another pair of feet trudging along as quickly as mine were. I picked up the pace to escape the sound from behind me, but I couldn't. The tunnel was so cramped I couldn't even look over my shoulder without having to turn my whole body to accommodate it. And I couldn't point my arm in that direction to at least shoot down in the direction of the malicious footsteps. But I could still see out of my peripheral vision what was behind me. I suddenly ran out of ground to walk on and fell onto a hard and rocky surface. I looked up and could still see the sun just barely permeating through the foliage that covered the pit I had fallen into. My flashlight was a few feet away from me, facing the dirt wall. The gun that John had given me was somewhere behind me, but not easily visible. The smells down here were unbearable, but in my gut, I knew where I was. I grabbed my flashlight and turned it around to where I had once landed, to see a mass grave of mutilated and rotting corpses. I began to throw up from the sight and the smell. It was all too surreal to me. I shined my flashlight up to the tunnel and saw an all too familiar face standing there, fully dressed, in a fucking clown suit. And I couldn't believe my eyes. Blake Jernigan was standing in the tunnel where I had fallen from, much older than he was in the picture that was captured by the newspaper when all of those killings had happened. His hair was rather long and matted, and his face was covered in a crude white powder makeup and a dark red makeup smile surrounding his mouth. I looked up at him. "Are you responsible for all this?" I could now taste the horrible smell in the room as I was trying so hard not to gag. "You killed your own brother and you chased the only other person down here so there wouldn't be any other witnesses?" Blake scoffed and rolled his eyes. "You really think that I killed my brother, huh?" The sunlight became much stronger now and I looked up and saw John's face smiling down at me as he picked up the pitfall trap cover. I now realized I had completely fucked up. Both of these two were in on the killings from the very beginning. The sick camp counselors. "Why did you guys kill all those kids?" John then looked down at me and said, "You don't need a motive to show and teach some bratty ass kids a lesson." Blake then laughed at his brother. As they began to conversate to each other, I remembered that the gun had fallen behind me. All I would have to do was grab it. I fell backwards and began to feel my way through the crevices of the rotting bodies that were near me. "Hey, you little shithead," Blake shouted. "You do know that that gun that my brother gave you was an airsoft gun, right?" And they both began to laugh. "Oh yeah? And both of you know that I have a family that'll look for me, right?" I shouted back. Blake took on a sarcastic tone at this point and said, "Oh no, we didn't forget about your family. Just shine that flashlight to your left, buddy boy." I did as he told me to do. And to my horror, I saw my mom's head sticking out. Her eyes were glazed over and her face was very dirty. She had a somewhat large hole in the middle of her forehead. And I saw the body of my father as well. John then yelled down to me. "I called Blake when I was packing and I told him where you lived. We couldn't leave anyone that would link to you." I couldn't look anymore and I was struggling to fight the tears at this point. I shined the flashlight back up at Blake, who was wiping away fake tears from his face. "Oh, don't worry, Tyler. You're going to be with him soon enough," he said. I looked down at the ground and back up to him, wiping the tears from my eyes. "Why did you two do this to me?" I asked. My voice was breaking at this point. And John looked down at me. "I told you that you shouldn't put your fucking nose in places that don't belong." I looked at both of them and then asked, "Was Nathan Holder actually real?" But neither responded. Blake then pulled out a pistol from his pocket and aimed it at me. I knew that this moment was going to come. The last thing I remember from before I died was hearing the gunshot that echoed throughout the pit. And then I painfully gasped for air in the last few seconds of my stupidly short life. Let my last dying wish be that everyone stays away from Camp Blue Jack.